Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
Consider me prepped and ready to go.
Hello, caller.
Ah, Mr. Alan Cumming, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. How are you?
Very good. Can I welcome you to a very special episode of Homo Sapiens?
How juicy and lovely.
If you think this is juicy, Alan, you hold tight, my friend.
Oh, I know. Wait. Because our guest today, viewing millions, is none other than Dan Savage, sex columnist and media commentator and author and sexy and sexual renaissance man.
Yes.
So it's going to be fascinating. Excuse me. I'm having coffee today for the first time in like 10 days.
And how's that feeling?
Fabulous! I feel really...
I would
bit jingly
recommend
second
just
cup.
Turning down Alan's volume a little today, just in case. It would be a little high energy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dan Savage has got... It's the Savage Love cast, isn't it?
Yeah, Savage Love's his column in The Stranger, which is a newspaper in Seattle. And it's also in other places as well. I think he's syndicated across the United States of the Americas. And he's got a podcast and he's on telly.
And that's
everywhere.
That's how I came to know him, because of his podcast, Savage Lovecast, where people phone in and he gives advice.
Yeah.
And it's very, and I'm sure lots of people listen to it, because it's...
Yes, I'm sure.
It's a queer institution.
Yes.
Much like us.
But who wants to be in an institution?
One of the things that I really want to talk to him about is that he had a phone relationship with Jake Shears. When Jake Shears and the Scissor Sisters was coming out.
That's right. When Jake was like baby, a little baby Jake, wasn't it? When he was coming out. We talked about that when we interviewed Jake, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so cute. So and he really helped him, and then they became real life friends.
Yeah, and he's like Dan.
That's nice.
The thing about Dan Savage is he's sort of the anti-shame-ometer. You know, he's just good at cutting through why you shouldn't be ashamed of anything sexual.
Totally.
Political.
And that's unusual in the USA, let me tell you. And that's why I think he's so celebrated and so unique, and also so kind of vilified and feared in some quarters as well for this openness and lack of shame. Because those are not qualities that America, certain quarters of America like or espouse.
What's even better, because the man dishes out some of the best advice in the business. Agony Uncles today, listeners.
It's special edition, ladies and gentlemen.
We're going to go straight to what do you call it? What's the... We're going to...
The nub.
The nub. And we're going to get Dan to answer your Agony Uncle questions.
Agony Uncle.
I mean...
With special guest, Dan Savage.
Finally, you're going to get hold of some vaguely decent advice.
I know, not our amateur psychology coffee-infused ramblings. Yeah. It's going to be Dan Blooming Savage. So let's head over and talk to the man, Dan. I'm really glad to see you've got your Impeach the Motherfucker Already t-shirt on, first off.
Yeah, we had a few left over after we shut down the shop after the motherfucker got impeached. And so it's basically all I wear, because I'm too cheap to buy clothes for myself.
Did you know about this? Because this was a campaign that Dan had to get Trump impeached. A successful campaign.
Another one. Yeah, yes. I claim all the credit.
And and you had all this merch going, let me see it on your chest.
ITMFA.
Impeach the motherfucker already.
And what was great about the shirts is you would wear them out, you know, back when we could fly, you'd be wearing one on an airplane and someone would say, what does that mean? And you would say, impeach the motherfucker already. And then their reaction told you everything you needed to know about your
seatmate.
Yes.
This is, look at my t-shirt. It's also of a similar bent in terms of reaction. Can you see it?
Fuck yoga.
Yeah, it says fuck yoga on it. It was a brand that actually I was the poster boy for years and years ago. I was in Vancouver and I had a little fuck yoga tank top, because obviously, you know, I'm like you, I have loads of the merch left over, and I was wearing it in the gym of the hotel I was staying in, and I was like, you know, at one of those machines doing the up and down things, the gym man came over to me and was going, I'm so sorry, I hate to have to do this. And I was like, oh, he wants an autograph. That's really what I thought.
Wants a selfie.
And yes, and he said, it was kind of before the days of selfies, actually. And he said, I'm going to have to ask you to leave the gym. I was like, what? And he said that some of our patrons are offended by your shirt. I was like, what? And I looked down, and it's my fuck yoga shirt. And I was like, why? It's a joke. And he went, well, some of them are actually, you know, do practice yoga here. And I was like, well, so do I. Look at my body. I'm obviously not a gym bunny. And they asked me to leave. I said, come on, Canada.
When I saw the shirt on you at first, I thought it said, fuck Yoda. I thought you'd get thrown out of a Star Wars convention for wearing that.
is your t-shirt still for sale, Dan?
No. ITMFA was a riff on DTMFA, which is shorthand in my column for dump the motherfucker already. Because if you write an advice column, half the time you're just telling people they need to break up with the asshole they wrote the letter about. And when George Bush was president, I sold ITMFA merch, you know, when he was committing war crimes and it felt like he should get impeached. And I brought it back for Trump and ended up raising $300,000 for the ACLU, the International Refugee Assistance Project, and oh my God, and Planned Parenthood, and another 50 for 30 for Puerto Rican hurricane relief.
Wow, so it was so great.
My contribution and my listeners' contribution to the resistance in the first couple of years. But after he got impeached, it felt a little silly, although we could have, you know, gone from impeach the motherfucker already to impeach the motherfucker again.
Yes. Yeah. So funny. That's it's I'm always really intrigued by you, the way you kind of, you know, have this kind of duality between sexual advice and politics.
Well, whenever I write anything about politics, I hear from a whole bunch of readers, often more conservative readers because they're interested in sex too. And people will write in and say, oh, I read you for sex. Leave politics alone. Stick to sex. And I always write those people back and say, I will leave politics alone when politicians leave sex alone.
Oh, that's good.
But they don't, so I can't.
Oh, that's really good. I get a lot of, like, you know, it's a lot of famous people do, like, you know, oh, shut up. Why should I listen to celebrities, blah, 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 all that stuff. And it's, you know.
There's no upside and no results in pointing out the hypocrisies of Republicans. But the people who always say, shut up, you're just an actor, are the same people who put Scott Baio on the stage at the Republican National Convention. The same people who say, shut up and dribble to African-American basketball stars. Also, then if there's a sports person who's pro-Trump, we'll immediately put that person on Fox News.
Of course.
It's only to shut up the left that they say these things.
Exactly. Yes. And the thing is, it's because, you know, most artists and people with compassion and kindness are more likely to be, Democrats.
The problem with Republicans and conservatives is always that they lack moral imagination, that they lack empathy. They can't project themselves into anyone else's experience, which is why you're constantly seeing conservatives and Republicans who support gay marriage when their own kid comes out. When your kid is gay and would like to get married, fuck your kid. They support treatment for drug addiction as opposed to incarceration when they get addicted to OxyContin in the case of Rush Limbaugh. When it happens to them, they suddenly see the social justice in that thing that before they couldn't see. And artists and actors and writers, you have to be able to project yourself into someone else's experience. You have to be capable of feeling empathy and imagining what it might be like to walk in someone else's shoes.
Yes.
And therefore, you are
so good.
You're pro-choice even if you're a gay guy because you get it. Because you can imagine what it would be like someone telling you what you can and can't do with your body because you understand that. And Republicans fucking don't, because they lack empathy and moral imagination.
But I think it's also true, that point you're making, that it's also that gives people, right-wing people, they can also use that argument to say, well, I have a gay brother, so I can't be homophobic. Or do you know what I mean? There's that as well. It's an added sort of layer of that
There's
lack of
plenty
imagination.
Of gay people who are homophobic, so let alone having a gay brother.
Yeah.
But Dan, I wanted to ask you, because about your childhood and stuff, and what was that like? And, you know, what kind of family did you grow up in?
I grew up in a large Irish Catholic family on the north side of Chicago. My dad was a cop. My uncles are cops. My brother's a cop. So a cop family.
In Chicago, you went to a school that was like sort of a fast track to becoming a priest.
Yeah, it's called the Preparatory Seminary. My dad was a Catholic deacon. Deacons are what priests are when they're apprentices. You know, you were ordained as a deacon and then a year later ordained as a priest. And to address the priest shortage in the 70s, the Catholic Church created the permanent diaconate, where they would take married Catholic men, make them deacons, and they would have an agreement that if your wife died, you would then become a priest. And so my father was in the first class of the permanent diaconate and was, you know, I'm a preacher's kid. He was on the altar every week at the church where I grew up and went to school. And I thought about becoming a priest. And then one day I realized I could wear dresses and sleep with men without having to get ordained. Spare myself the bother or pretending to believe.
There's so much to unpack there.
Just less glam.
Yeah. First of all, there was a priest shortage.
There still is because of...
Is there?
Because of the celibacy requirement. And also, you know, we joke about how many priests are closeted gay men. Well, once gay men had the option of being out, and our only two options, at least for like us Catholic gay men, wasn't a marriage that was a lie or the priesthood. Once we could live as openly gay men, and we fought for that and, you know, did that, then the Catholic Church was sort of starved for all these closeted gay priests. You know, that was the option open to me. You know, I'm 55 years old, so I'm old. And I came out in 1980. And in the 70s, the options that I was wrestling with when, you know, I was closeted and a teenager, and my dad was a Catholic and a cop and practically a priest and very homophobic, was find a woman that I can close my eyes and jack off inside convincingly, have sex with, or become a priest. And I, you know, I still believed when I went into high school. And so I was like, all right, I'm not going to break my parents' hearts or get exiled from my family. I'm going to become a priest and they're going to like that, rather than become a fag, which I knew they wouldn't like, or not become a fag, tell them I was a fag and had always been a fag.
Did you know that when you were thinking of becoming a priest, that there was sort of gayness accepted within the priesthood?
No, I didn't know that. And I was remarkably, I feel like I walked through a hail of bullets and didn't get a scratch, because I worked in a rectory and I went to a seminary, and I had classmates and friends who were sexually abused, and I was never, maybe because my father was a cop. I don't know. Other kids I know who were gay. It was often the gay kids that the priests preyed upon, because they relied on our own sense of shame and complicity, even though we had been, you know, gay kids who were targeted by priests were being raped and victimized. There was this conflict in a lot of gay kids about whether, because of our sexuality or nascent sexuality, we had invited this or brought it on ourselves or initiated it or wanted it. And a lot of the other kids that, you know, that I knew that went through the same places I went through who were gay were preyed upon, and I wasn't. And, you know, the joke is, you know, one of my chopped lived her. That's often the joke that people sardonically and bitterly make. But yes, I think the reality was there was a little zone of protection around me, because they all fucking knew my dad, and they all fucking knew my dad was a cop.
Fascinating.
Wow. And then when did you've radically changed since then, let's say, you know, like, was there a moment, was there a person who you met and you just said, actually, I'm going to fuck all this shame off and be me?
You know, I came out, you know, I was born in 1964. So by 1975, when I was 10, 11 years old, the gay rights movement, then the lesbian and gay rights movement, then the, you know, as the acronym expanded, and rightfully so, was a presence. And the adults in my life were talking about it. Stonewall happened when I was 5 years old. And I was really fortunate in that I grew up in Chicago. Also fortunate that my parents, you know, their sideline was managing a restaurant. So they actually knew some gay people that were the okay gay people. You know, my dad was a homicide detective, so most of the gay people he met or knew were murderers or murdered. But he knew a couple of gay waiters, and as much as he disapproved and wouldn't let them be around his sons, they were okay. But what really saved me was growing up in a big city where I could get on my bike and ride around, and I saw gay men out in public. Right. And I have this memory etched, this indelible memory of being in line with my parents to see Logan's Run at the Water Tower Theater in downtown Chicago when I was, I don't know, 11 or 12. And there were two gay men in front of us, obviously gay, holding hands. And my mother, she's there with all four of her children. She wraps her arms only around me because she knew that I was the one who would see that and want to like run away, you know, with Peter Pansies. Wow. She wrapped around me, kept saying to my father, "They're weird, they're weird, they're weird," about these guys in front of us in line. And I was looking at them and I was like, oh, okay, I get it. I'm weird like them. I get it. I understand. And look at them. They're in love. They're happy. They're fearless. And I burned them into my memory. I remember how one of them was wearing a belt. Like he had this long belt that went around his waist, but then also around his, through his leg and then back up his crotch. It was a very weird way to wear a long belt. But it was
like a little harness almost.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember those two guys, and odds are one or the other, both of them died within the decade. And they saved my life because of how brave they were. Like, you know, to be openly gay in a shopping mall in downtown Chicago now, maybe not, that doesn't require guts, but then at that moment in front of a cop, a Chicago cop.
And also what we were talking about earlier, you know, can you say, why are you talking about politics when you're talking about sex? Well, that was political and sexual right there in front of you. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. And unless people combine the two, you're not going to make progress.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's also funny. Like, do you think that couple heard your mum saying they're weird, they're weird?
I don't know. You know, no one's ever asked me that question. Maybe they heard it. My mother was not an asshole. She had opinions, but she was never impolite to people. The people that she disapproved of. And I don't want to paint my parents in too bad a light, because they were only operating with the information they had at the time, which, if my parents had been parenting a gay kid in the 90s, they would have been very different. But all they knew about gayness then was it was something a kid drifted into, like drugs or punk rock music, or like a ship might drift into port or drift out to sea. And what you had to do if you felt your kid drifting in one of those directions was just nudge them. So they nudged me a lot, and it was from a place of love and operating with the information they had at the time. But the nudging was, for me, traumatizing, because all it communicated to me was they disapproved. That if they really knew who I was, they wouldn't love me. Every time they said, "I love you," after I was like 11, I was literally, the voice in my head said, "No, you don't."
Really? Really?
Oh, Dan.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Right.
I also think it's funny that you were in the line for Logan's Run, because I think of Logan's Run as the kind of a weird sort of analogy for gay culture, because for people who are listening who don't know it, it's this sort of sci-fi film. It's got Farrah Fawcett in it.
Yeah. And hot Michael York.
Michael York, that's right. Post Cabaret. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of like a world where at age 30 or something, you go to this dome or something, and you kind of... And something happens to you and people don't know what it is. Basically, you get killed because there's not enough people, there's too many people on the planet. I always thought that was like gay life. Do you know what I mean?
After 30, you were executed in a Thunderdome?
You sort of age out. And you kind of, we were talking about that with a guest recently, about that sort of ageism within our culture, and about how, you know, that it's all those things like body fascism, blah, blah, but also just like seeing old people. Older people in environments like clubs or bar. I always loved, and that's like, you know, why one of the reasons why I started Club Cumming was to sort of have a place for all ages. But it's not kind of it's not common in gay culture. And I think that's I've always thought that Logan's Run was a sort of
there's a lot in Logan's Run that I think anticipates some aspects of gay culture and straight culture now. There's nothing gay people did that straight people didn't adopt once they were free to themselves. You know, we called them fuck buddies and they called them friends with benefits. We called it tricking. They called it hooking up. They just took all our shit and renamed it. But they basically do everything that we used to do or used to be perceived as just gay. That's one of the things that's really interesting about writing about like politics and sex and sexuality and gay people and straight people over the last 30 years is just watching this line dissolve. That there was nothing gay about the gay lifestyle and there was nothing straight about the straight lifestyle. It was just the border was policed. Gay people weren't allowed to do anything but what, you know, the dominant culture then condemned us for doing. And straight people weren't allowed either, which right-wing nut jobs in the 60s and 70s correctly anticipated that straight people knowing gay people would undermine this sort of assembly line that got straight people married and pregnant and packed off to the suburbs by age 22 and living just one sort of way. Because the lesson that straight people take if they ever go to a gay pride parade is look at all these different ways to be queer. Why is there just one way to be straight? And so gay and queer liberation has been destabilizing of heterosexuality. In this, at the same time that in some ways, you know, homonormativity or heteronormativity among gay people that some queer left people freak out about. So there are a lot of gay people out there who were consigned to bars and bathhouses and bushes and prevented from marrying and parenting, not because they didn't want all those things, but they weren't allowed them. And it was different. But what's really interesting about Logan's Run is there's an internet in Logan's Run where people get online to hook up. People are delivered to your apartment on this thing. I can't remember the name of the machine, but it's basically a hookup app. But instead of seeing a picture of the person, they're standing before you for a second in this thing that like can zap them into your apartment. And there's like plastic surgery and this cult of youth. There's a lot of things that seem gay culture-y in Logan's Run. And of course,
gay culture.
Hot Michael York, which can't hot be discounted. Although now he's right wing. Awful Michael York, so he's not hot.
Oh,
even
he's
at his
not.
Age.
Does he?
Yeah, he's really? A right winger now.
Oh,
so ugly on the inside.
Oh God, that's annoying.
Can we talk about ageism in the gay community for a second?
Let's,
because I think it's overblown, and I'm almost 60, so I think I have the right to say, as an older gay person, I think it's kind of overblown.
As it made out to be more of a problem than it is.
Some, you know, I get letters all the time from guys who say I'm 50. And these 25-year-olds won't sleep with me. Ageism. And I will write them back and say, what about sleeping with other 50-year-olds? Well, I'm not attracted to men my own age. Okay, so who's ageist in this equation? And who's the author of your problem?
That's funny.
And
I don't mean it like that. I didn't mean it like that. I meant it more like it being welcome in certain environments. Like clubs, like certain bar, like that. I think I totally agree with you on that one. I think the double standards of that.
But I don't think I don't think that's peculiar to the gay community or queer community.
No.
You know, if you're a 60-year-old straight guy and you go to certain kinds of straight meat market pickup clubs for college students, you're going to not feel comfortable. People are going to ignore
that's
you.
True.
And I'm not saying that that's right in either environment, but we talk about it in gay environments as if this doesn't happen in straight land. And it kind of does, and it kind of sucks. But there are bars in Seattle that I stopped going to when I turned 40 something, because it was just like, this is a 22-year-old's bar. It's not like I don't have bars that I can go to. And it's not like the 22-year-olds who want to fuck 40-year-olds don't know where those bars are. They do. And they show up in them.
My friend always said you should stop going to clubs when you start looking like undercover police.
Hey, fellow kids, like what's his face with the skateboard in Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh yes.
But yeah, I always found the gay world very like, I loved that there was older people and younger people in the same space. I don't know, I always enjoyed that.
That's interesting. I suppose that when you were talking, I thought, is it partly to do with that thing that there's that missing generation because of AIDS? There's a missing generation of sort of, you know, elders or mentors. So there's probably a kind of a lack of connection because they're not there.
Yeah. Even if those mentors existed, everybody didn't die in the HIV AIDS epidemic.
No.
There are a lot of gay men my age and older, and I'm at the tail end of the gay guys who's, you know, one day looked around and said, all my friends are dead. like guys who are my age and older experienced that. Mm. Guys who are my age and younger tended not to experience that. Mm. But we didn't all drop dead. There's not often an easy way for young queer people to access their mentors, because we don't raise the next generation of ourselves in the same way Jewish parents, you know, raise Jewish kids. Queer kids aren't raised by queer parents. And it often seems like every incoming wave of young queer people who are coming out, who are entering our spaces, our communities, their spaces, have to learn shit that we think we should all have learned by now, but they were isolated and ignorant and kept ignorant. And then they show up. You know, the example I always give is no fats, no femmes, no Asians on personal ads, which I've written a million columns decrying, and I think it's terrible. And it feels like
Should we just say what that is for people who don't listening who don't know what that means?
Yes.
On Grindr or other dating apps, where mostly gay white men do this thing where they have their precious preferences and they're not attracted to people of other races or people who, you know, whose bodies don't fit some beauty standard that often their bodies themselves don't fit. And they will put on their bottom of their ad, you know, no fats, no femmes, no Asians, no blacks. In this way that is just scalding and depressing and wearying if you are Asian, if you are heavy set, if you are black, to constantly encounter.
If you're effeminate, that's the other one.
Or effeminate.
So crazy.
And the thing is that you see gay men unlearn that. Like a gay guy who's 20 puts that on his ad. He's just come out, or he came out a few years ago, has never been challenged on it. He gets challenged by it, about it, over and over and over again. Hopefully, eventually, gets it through his thick skull why this is hurtful and why he shouldn't do this. And then he stops. And he has been replaced, by the time he stops, with the next wave of young gay men who are doing that. And so because we don't raise each other, because we don't have a culture that instills as a value in, you know, prepubescent young gay kids or queer kids, why this isn't something you say, why this just creates hurt in the world that's unnecessary and easily avoidable. And you can have your precious preferences. Hopefully you will think through them so you realize whether or not your preferences are actually yours. You know, that's also something people often learn, that, you know, I'm sleeping with people I'm not actually attracted to because I've been told I should find these people attractive. And you have to look inside and go, like, am I attracted to more kinds of people or different kinds of people than I've allowed myself to perceive or be aware? And that's a process. And the problem, I think, with the perception in queer communities and queer spaces and the way we complain about these things is we just can never accept that this is going to be a never-ending process. This is the parenting of young queer people that we all must do, because we can't parent young queer people, really. We're going to have to parent them when they're 18 or 20 or 25, because we're not raising them when they're 5. We're not their parents.
Yeah. Right.
And so there's going to be all of this. This is going to be a constant. And I you know, get in my soapbox about this because people will point to this as evidence that it gets no better and that we make no progress and that, you know, gay people are as racist as they've ever been. And it's just, okay, this is something we're always going to have to do. And the fact that we're doing it is the evidence that we are pushing back, that these aren't queer community values. Because watch the pushback when somebody does it. That's, you know, racism, sexism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, transphobia, it's always going to exist in any culture. And the signifier of the health or value or of that culture is what's the reaction when those things manifest.
Right.
And is it a passive reaction? Is there no challenge? Is there no fight? And I think in queer spaces, you see challenge and fight. And that is where we should look, like the Mr. Rogers thing. Look for the helpers. Look for the challengers. Look for the people who are getting in the faces of the people who put no fats, no femmes, no Asians on their ads, and they're out there.
So do you mean it's like we have a more of a collective responsibility?
We do.
As a group. Because it's so interesting you say that, because we talked on the podcast recently to this really fascinating young guy called Adam Eli, and he's written a book called The New Queer Conscience. Is that right?
Yeah.
And what he bases... sort of like he says the qualities in Judaism, he's Jewish, about like how everyone looks after each other and educates each other, and you know, that's what we need to bring into queer life. And I thought that was such a fascinating,
it's incredible, and such a brilliant blueprint for like
so we, what we don't have, that sort of looking out for each other thing, and you know, having and as you say, educating. Dan, I was curious about why you went to Berlin, because you spent a couple of years in Berlin in the late 80s. What was
I
that
did.
About?
My then boyfriend, Peter, got a fellowship with the West German government to study arts management in West Berlin. And they were so far ahead of us on the rights of queer people at that time that I, as his, just as his boyfriend, not his spouse, not domestic partner, none of that existed then, could get a residence permit to come with him, to accompany him to Berlin. And so we were just a couple of college kids, and we moved to this far-flung neighborhood called Zehlendorf, which is on the edge of West Berlin, right by the wall. And we were in West Berlin in 89 and 90, and we went for the wall coming down. After the wall came down, we were reading about the riot in Prague, and I said, let's go. And we were in Prague for the Velvet Revolution.
Oh
we snuck
God.
Money in our toothpaste tubes and our anuses. And we were in Prague for the Velvet Revolution, because you would change money on the black market in this one neighborhood in West Berlin, this one plaza, and then sneak off into Eastern Europe rich, you know, because you had so much money if you got it on the black market as opposed to the official exchange rate over there. And you know, I was in Wenceslas Square when the communist government fell. I saw Alexander Dubček and Václav Havel speak from the balcony of whatever hotel it was on that square. And it was just a transformative time in my life. There's an interesting story
about
us going into Prague, and there were no tourists in Prague. It was November. Tanks were lined up outside the city. The communist government was talking about a Tiananmen solution to these growing demonstrations. And we were approached on a street corner by these college students who gave us hand-typed flyers in Russian, German, English, and French, and asked us to smuggle them out of the country about what was really going on in Prague, because they didn't know what was being reported outside the country. There was no internet. They had no access to Western media. And they didn't know how it was being characterized, and they wanted the truth told, and they all thought they were going to die, that there was a real good chance they were going to die. And we were we went with these kids who intercepted us. Well, we were their same age. We were just kids. We went with them back to the philosophy building at the university, and went into the room where they're all sitting around a table typing these flyers over and over again to try to find the 12 tourists in Prague in November when it's freezing cold to smuggle these things out. And we get intercepted because we're wearing Levi's and leather jackets, and those are the uniforms of the secret police who are pretending to be tourists or pretending to be
hip.
And they don't have access to jeans and leather jackets. And so, you know, we could be secret police, and we were grilled, and finally we were like, we are fags, we are not secret police. This is my boyfriend. I'm his boyfriend. Watch us kiss. Like, we're not the secret police, wouldn't do this, right? And they were like, okay, you're not the secret police. And then they allowed us to like hang out.
Did you actually have to kiss?
In the telling and retelling, I think we kissed, but I couldn't
it's better.
Be sure.
You did.
Yeah, we did.
You've got to keep that bit. I love it.
You know, the night that the communist government fell, there were two things that happened that, you know, and we didn't speak Czech, and so we were getting everything in German and English from other people in the square who were just flabbergasted that there were Americans there. When the announcement was made that the first indication that something crazy had just happened was there were all these state-run bars and taverns and restaurants, not a lot, but a few around the square. And you heard breaking glass, which was a little scary. And it was because the workers in the restaurants were breaking out the windows so they could pass out steins of beer out the windows into the protests into the streets. And then, and this is always like, makes me cry to talk about, especially at this moment when Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia seem to be slipping back toward fascism, when the United States is slipping quickly toward authoritarianism and fascism. There's this moment where the crowd, there's 500,000 people in the square, and the square can accommodate 500,000 people, surges in one direction, this giant Stalinist building with this balcony at the top. And those Stalinist buildings were always designed in such a way to make people look tiny. and powerless against the power of the state. And it was the offices of their Pravda, the big daily newspaper. And they're chanting for the editor to come out. And this little man appears on the balcony, and there's no amplification. Nobody has a bullhorn. And so the whole crowd hushes itself so they can hear what this guy is going to say. And they're chanting, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because one of the things that happened right before the government fell was the paper broke with the government and started printing what was actually happening. And they were thanking the paper and the editors and the writers for coming over to the side of the revolution. And the editor like quiets the crowd and then says, don't thank us. We lied to you for 40 years. We have to apologize to you. And then ask the crowd, instead of thanking them, if they could all sing the national anthem together, which as a callow young American, I was like, oh God, a national anthem is bombastic and bombs bursting in air and it's militaristic and xenophobic. Like I was expecting some national anthem out of, you know, a ballpark because of my experience of national anthems.
Yeah, yeah.
And ballparks. And and everybody raises their hands and makes a little V sign. And then they bow their heads and they sing the Czech national anthem, which is, where is my homeland? Which is a question. Not a statement, not a threat, not a bomb. It's a question. And it just gutted me at the time. And it still makes me cry because Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic now and Slovakia have had this experience, like Poland, of being wiped off the map over and over and over again. So for the national anthem to be, where is my homeland? As opposed to, we kicked their asses, didn't we?
Yeah.
Just broke my heart. And
Wow. Dan, I did not think that you would be crying about the Czech Republic on this podcast. This took a turn, but a really fascinating one.
Yeah, those were really important times in my life. And just those experiences. And, you know, I've never like really folded them into my work or written about them because they're not relevant to me explaining to straight people how to have a three-way.
What a great first part. That's the end of part one. Part two is available now in your feed. Head over there, crack open a cup of tea, click play, have a listen. Part two is great too.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Powered by Spirit Studios.